originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm sitting here in our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank all of you listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, also to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. As you know, a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have given everything to the sport. If you're able to help, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening, he's won 19 Group 1 races in Europe and 29 in total around the world. He was Great Britain's champion apprentice in 1991, and as I mentioned, he's had success all over the world, including South Korea, Singapore, Italy, Germany, France, Japan, the list goes on. But now, he has decided to make his home base right here in the States at Gulfstream Park with nearly 2,000 wins and counting. I can't wait to hear his story, jockey Daryl Holland. Daryl, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So great to have you on the show, Daryl. And how are you adjusting to life in the States?
I'm very well, actually. First of all, the climate here is really great, and which I really enjoy. I'm not very good in the cold weather and wet weather of the UK. And secondly, I get looked after really well here. We have ponies to take us to the start, and we have a stall handler in the gate. So, it's pretty easy enough, yeah.
You know, I don't even think about that. I'm just so used to, I've only ever ridden here in the States, and I guess we are a bit spoiled with lead ponies and the gate crew. And what's that like in Europe, dealing with, you're basically on your own as soon as you get a leg up?
Well, that's right. We have the, obviously, the lad or the stable lasts walkers around the paddock. We actually go out to the parade ring 15 minutes before, because we obviously speak to the owners as they do in the States. But then we're sort of like led off when we get off onto the track, and then we have to canter, or as in America, gallop our way to the starting gate, which could be anything up to 2,000 full miles to get there, depending on what distance it is, because most of our tracks are all, you know, natural tracks where they put rails up hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years ago, you know. So this is where it all started. Obviously, we've got a couple of all-weather tracks, which are man-made. But, it's a lot different. It's a lot different in the UK and Europe itself.
And tell me about the start. How is it handling these horses, getting them set up by yourself for the start? That has to be difficult.
Yeah, obviously, you know, as yourself ridden before, you know, you can have horses, and they're very highly strung animals on, you know, particular race day. You know, you get some that, you know, will lob or, you know, do an icy, you can't do the start, and then you'll get one that will wrestle you, you know, i.e. a sprinter that only knows going slow or flat out. So, yeah, you can have a bit of a hard time, and, you know, having sort of like 10, 14 rides in a day, you know, when you get home at night, you pretty much sleep very well.
I would think so, Daryl. Definitely a bit more challenging than what we have to deal with here in the States.
Yeah.
But Daryl, I want to start off now. I want to start off with hearing about your young life, how you grew up and how you first got introduced to this sport.
Well, funny enough, really, I actually wasn't raised within a racing family. I didn't have any, you know, any history of having horses around me. I was actually brought up in the city of Manchester. For those listeners who are listening, you know, that's where Manchester United are, and Man City. So I was very much brought up in a you know, that sort of environment. So I don't know where I got the sort of like the affinity with horses from. I just said to my father when I was about 14, late 14, I said to him, you know, can we go to the racetrack? So he took me to Chester Racecourse, which is actually the nearest one to Manchester, about an hour's drive away, and I just fell in love with it. I just absolutely fell in love with the horses galloping round in between two rails flat out, and I thought, I want to do that. And then when I got to sort of like the next year, 15, I applied for three jobs. I applied one to Frankie Durr, one to the late Sir Henry Cecil, and one to Barry Hills. So I actually ended up going for a work experience for 2 weeks to Frankie Durr's, and then I came back. And then in the meantime, the late Henry Cecil, he accepted me, and Barry Hills accepted me as well. So I decided to go to Barry Hills's because he was the leading trainer at the Chester Racecourse, and he always seemed to win there. So I kind of like chose him through that reason. And then I went down and I started full-time as an apprentice with him. I was on £45 a week. So, yeah, that's where it was.
That's where it was, Daryl. And you were just 15 when you started working for Barry Hills. And what was it like when you first arrived? And you mentioned you didn't really come from a racing background. I'm assuming you didn't really work with horses much.
No, that's right. You're right. I mean, it was a bit daunting, to be honest with you, because I'd never been away from home for that long. And here I was with a lot of lads and lassies there. Obviously, all of them were all older than me. And it was a new environment, new faces around. I had to like gel with people pretty quick. And, you know, a married couple who worked for the stables took me under their wing and kind of like treated me like, you know, a father, mother and father figure, you know, when I was away from home. So that really helped. So it was a good base to be at the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I said, never sat on a horse before. Obviously, I had to do all the stable duties, mucking out and, you know, coming back and watering the horses in the afternoon and, you know, and feeding and just doing all the general duties of an apprentice, which was, you know, was a lot tougher than what it is now. And then I used to sort of, like, when the lads or lassies come back on a quiet one, the trainer would say I could walk it back home after it had, you know, after it had done its work. So it'd obviously be quiet after it had breezed, and then I'd walk it back, and then he'd put me on a trotter, a quiet trotter, and then I was on a, you know, I was hack cantering, and that's how I literally got going. Well, within a year, I was actually breezing horses, you know, besides the like of Steve Cawthon, because he was actually stable jockey at the time. He's obviously he'd be well familiar with the USA people, having come from Kentucky. I think he was from Kentucky, wasn't he, Steve Cawthon?
Yes, very. Familiar name around these parts.
Yeah, so I was breezing horses alongside him, and you know, it just all came, well, to me it came sort of like easy, and you know, my trainer thought that I was natural at what I was doing, and I just fitted in. I just felt right being a part of that horse, and yeah, it was memories I'll never forget, you know, being an apprentice down there.
You say how easy it came to you in the beginning. Obviously so. If you were breezing horses within a year, that's not a long amount of time. But were you athletic as a younger boy? Did you find that maybe helped your skills in the saddle?
I was small enough. You know, I was lightly boned. I mean, I wouldn't say I was great at one particular sport, but I was sort of like an all-rounder. If I played any sport, I could hold my own. But it was horse racing where, you know, I seemed to excel when I sort of like came out of school. But I was always very interested in sort of like football, tennis, you know, rounders, or, you know, just any sort of sport I'd participate and do, you know, I'd do quite well, you know, in. And I was a good runner. I had good stamina. I could, you know, I ran for Manchester Boys and an amateur level. So, you know, I was quite good at that too.
All things that would help your athletic ability on the back of a horse. And you mentioned breezing horses with Steve Koth and Daryl, and I'm sure those are fantastic memories. Did he know, first of all, that you had aspirations to be a jockey, and did he give you any kind of advice?
He did. He always told me to be grounded, and, you know, just the typical things that when you have success, obviously money comes with that, and, you know, choose your friends carefully, and, you know, nothing lasts forever, and, you know, all this kind of information, which I always listen to, because if you lend your ear to somebody and you take it in, they're willing to help you more. And I mean, obviously Pat Edery was, we had horses for Prince Khalid Abdullah as well, and Pat Edery was the stable jockey, well, the late Pat Edery, he was stable Joel retained rider to Prince Khalid, so he come in as well, as did Willie Carson. I saw Lester Piggott there, he used to ride the Sangster horses. This was the second time he'd come back from retirement. So we had a lot of good jockeys around, and I just like took little bits from each, really. I think Steve was sort of like my favourite. He was my idol and still is, because he sort of like had the American, you know, the American style mixed with the European style. He was toeing the irons, whereas a lot of other jockeys were full foot, you know, typical English style. Steve used to hold the reins slightly shorter and crouched down, and I just felt he looked better on a horse than the English jockeys, so I kind of like followed that sort of like route, which put me in good stead.
So you would say you have a bit of his same riding style, you ride with a bit of that American style?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you've watched any of my races in the US, I've had four wins up to now, you know, since the 7 weeks I've been here. I mean, it's not been easy. You know, you have to start again. Whatever country you go to, you cannot rest on your laurels and think, well, my CV will get me through, because it simply doesn't. You're judged by new eyes. You're judged at what you do on the track. So it's like starting over again. And, you know, with me sort of like, you know, my age is 45 now, this gives me a real incentive and a real passion to do well, to prove people wrong. And as I said, I think, you know, people watching me here at Gulfstream would know my style slightly, you know, or is different from the typical rider from the States. But anybody sort of like from Europe watching me would think I pretty much fit in with it. You know, my style's pretty much, you know, like American too. So I guess it's probably who you're asking, really.
Jockey Daryl Holland is joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And I'm sure, Daryl, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've ridden so many different countries and places, and can't wait to hear all of those stories. But I'm sure it was a big adjustment, adjusting that riding style to fit all of those different places.
Yeah, absolutely. You're 100% right. And that's what you've got to do. You've got to learn to adapt. You know, the contours of the tracks are different. They can ride a little faster. You know, you've got to be in a good position. I think the number one key to any aspiring young jockey is position, because, you know, the race can be won from the start, the middle. It's not just the end. It's not just the winning line. It's not where you win the races. You know, people just watch the last furlong, or, you know, watch the last quarter of a race and think, wow, he gave that a good ride. And as yourself, you know, you've ridden before, you know, you could have given a horse not a very good ride, but you were on the best horse and won. It's, you know, the best jockeys make fewer mistakes, and that's the key to it.
Exactly. I always was told you try to lessen that degree of hindrance. You're trying to, obviously, on the back of a horse, you're adding weight and you're moving with the horse, but you want to be one. You want to flow with that animal to
correct,
create that, you know, lessen that hindrance anyway.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think it's like with horses, it's like people as well. I mean, a lot of the horses that you sit on in England and Europe, I mean, you're only really sitting on most of them for the first time. So you have to build up a good rapport from getting on them in the paddock to cantering them down to the post. And you have to get on. You have to get on well with each other in the short span you've got. And if you can do that and get on well with your partner, you normally get the better results out of the horse. I mean, at the end of the day, I simplify things. I have got to make this horse run as fast as it can in that race, because normally you come out the winner. It doesn't matter where you position, but, you know, as long as you make it as run as fast as it can, you're normally going to win. And I get on any horse thinking I can win, which is, you know, the reins are like, it's like a transmission to the horse's mouth. That is your communication. And they know when you're on a bad down, you know, they know when you're on a bad run. They know if you're having a bad day. These horses do know. They're actually smarter than what people think.
Mm-hmm. This is very true, Daryl. And tell the audience how you develop that relationship on the back of a horse. Literally, you have a couple minutes in the warm-up. You're warming up before the start after you get a leg up. Tell our audience how you develop that.
I normally look at them out the corner of my eye in the paddock just to see if they're on the toes or, you know, if they're sweating, you know, if they're nervous or you've got a one that's a bit colty, two-year-old first time out. You look by the eye first, and then as you approach the horse and you throw your leg over, you can actually feel the horse. And that might just get a little bit tense, you know, once you've placed your backside on the horse, because these saddles are really light. They're not like, you know, these saddles are not like training saddles where they're full of leather and a bit more robust. These are very light saddles we sit on. So, you know, the horses can feel every movement from us. So I just get that sort of feel. It's very hard to explain, but it's just that you know, if you have a nervous one, you have to keep that horse calm, because they're going to burn nervous energy, and that will blunt their chances.
Exactly. You want them to use save that energy for the race, and not
absolutely
use it up.
And that's what it's about. Yeah.
So Daryl, back to you were working for Barry Hills, Breezing Horses with Steve Cawthon. You were surrounded by all of these talented riders, incredibly talented riders. When did you decide that you were ready to start riding races, or was it a group effort? Did you talk to Mr. Hills, and how did that come about?
I certainly didn't decide. I was normally told what I had to do by Barry Hills. He was a very hard taskmaster. He was very fair, though. He was ruthless. He's retired now. His son Charlie Hills has taken over the mantle in Lambourne. But he said to me one day, I've put you down for a ride on Saturday. You're going to ride this horse. I think it was Sinclair Boy. He was carrying 10 stone in a mile handicap. And it had 10 stone, which is a lot of weight. I don't know what that is in pounds, but it was top weight on the handicap. And I was claiming 7. And I finished last on my first ride. And I was that exhausted, I couldn't even take my saddle off. I think the travelling head lad actually brought that in for me, because I had to weigh back in because it was a jockey's all way. But it was just so different from doing what I did breezing horses in the morning. Everything just happened in a blink, and I just couldn't really remember any part of it. So that's one thing I learned straight away. And I started to push too soon and, you know, things like that. And I just thought, this is not as easy as I thought. And I thought there's still a lot of work to be done. I was actually disappointed, very disappointed, because I'm a bad loser in terms of, you know, because I like to win. But I think that was the best thing that happened to me, that I didn't ride a winner and I finished last on my first ride.
Because you wanted to be that much better. It fueled that desire.
I guess. And then I thought, well, my boss is not going to give me another ride for a while after that. He did. He let me ride it, I think, about a month later. And it was the same horse, and it was my first winner, Warwick, at in 1989, Sinclair Boy, at Warwick Racecourse. Yeah, you never forget your first one.
No, you never do. So that same horse you finished last on, your very first ride, that same horse you rode back, and you won.
I won. Yeah, I just kept watching the videos, and you know, I think the ground was a bit soft. He didn't like the ground too soft, and we had better ground at Warwick, and the track was a lot different. And he he was a front runner, which it suits a front runner's track. So he had a lot going for him. But he won, and it was just the best feeling in the world. It was just, you're just at number one for that moment. And, you know, it's just it's a real self, you know, sense of achievement. It was just superb.
Best feeling in the world, in my opinion, Daryl. Nothing like it. There's nothing like it. Now, let me ask you this. You're in the States. I remember when I won my first race at Tampa. And after the race, I'm walking back to the jocks room, and here they all come with water and eggs and baby powder, and they threw it all on me, and that's like our initiation process when you're an apprentice and you win your first race. Do they do that in Europe?
No, we don't actually do that. I came in and, you know, a couple of the jocks said, is that your first winner, Jock? And I said, yes, sir. And, you know, because we had, you know, we even treated the older senior jockeys. We even called them sir at the time. I mean, not so much now. But we did back then. And I think it was George Duffield and Pat said, oh, well done, lad. And, you know, one of many, you know, and all this. And, yeah, I got a big cheer, which was nice. So it was nice that they embraced me and they accepted me into their, you know, their room, you know, because the jockey's room is a very private place and, you know, what goes on in there normally stays on in there. So, yeah, it was nice to feel part of, I don't know, the family, really.
It's a good way of putting it, Daryl, good way of putting it. Now, so you had your first winner, and did that bring about more mounts? Did you start riding more frequently?
I did. What happened then is Barry Hills, my boss, teamed up with Robert Sangster, a couple of owners, and they ended up buying five horses for the apprentices to ride in the yard. There was three apprentices there at the time, including myself. I ended up winning on them five horses. I ended up winning about 16 races on them. They were only cheap horses, you know, claimed out of claimers for 10,000. But all in all, out of the five horses, I won 16 races on them. So they had a good return for their investment, so to speak. And I did really well on, you know, off the back of them. And then I was getting notice from outside trainers. And then they were ringing me up because we didn't have agents at the time. And they was only real late on, the agents. Sort of like they came sort of like the probably the late 90s. They wasn't really introduced. So the trainers used to ring up the secretaries at your stable, and then they'd ask me to, you know, is Daryl going to Brighton or is Daryl going to Lingfield next Wednesday or Thursday? Has he got a ride in such and such a race? And if it was no or I wasn't required by my boss, then they'd normally let me ride it. And it just built up from there, and I lost my £7 claim very quickly. I think it was you have to do that with 15 winners, and then you're down to £5 claim, and then it was 50 winners. I still actually hold the post-war record for the amount of winners as an apprentice, which is 74 winners.
Wow.
You know, that still stands. It still beats Frankie De Torres, Lester Piggott. So I'm still in the record books for that. So it was a huge amount of winners that I rode as an apprentice bug rider.
That is a huge number. And for that record to still stand, because that was, what, 1991?
1990, I broke the record. I think Edward Hyde in the 60s held it previously to me. But he actually rang me and congratulated me and said, you know, records are there to be broken and you've done it.
Wow.
But if somebody comes along and breaks mine, you know, fantastic, because I know how much achievement and how much dedication and hard work it takes to get and do that.
And you also won a Leicester Award for Apprentice Jockey of the Year.
Yeah, I won a Leicester's Award, and I've managed to get three more for Ride of the Year on three different horses. Obviously, that was, you know, per year. But I've got four Leicester's Awards altogether, which is, you know, which have took pride of place at home, which is always nice to see.
I'm assuming that's similar to our Eclipse Awards?
Yes, it's exactly the same as that. It's we have sort of like an award ceremony at the end of the season, and then, you know, the champion jockey is given a bronze statue, and then obviously the newcomer and the apprentices, and then Rider of the Year, which I was voted Rider of the Year on 3 occasions. So yeah, it was nice achievement.
Most definitely, Daryl, you should be very proud. And I read an article about you, and you described something that I've never really had a conversation with any of my other guests about. And you described you called it the hangers-on, the people who kind of surround you when you're having all this success and everything like that. And describe what that's like, and is that good, or why was it bad? And tell us about that a little bit.
Well, what it is, you know, when you're successful, people want a part of that or to be a part of you. And as I said, you know, repeat myself, you know, when you're successful, you're winning these races, and then, you know, money comes with that. And then you get people that befriend you, and you think that they're your friend. You know, oh, I'll drive you to the races, or they're ringing you up, could you leave me a ticket to get into the races, and things like that. And you can actually get unknowingly tied up with people, or we call them undesirables, that they could be betting behind your back or doing unscrupulous things. And, you know, you have to keep your eyes wide open. And I think always trust your instincts, your gut instincts, would be the advice I would give. And, you know, and remember the people that were there before you were successful, and they're still there to this day. You know, I've my best school friend since I've known since four. He still is my best friend. We, you know, we see each other when we can. And, you know, and obviously your family and your mother and father play a big role as well. But you've just got to be very, you know, you've got to be on the side of cautious. But, you know, you've got to live your life too. So it's a bit of a fine line as well. So it's not, you don't always get it right. And you do make mistakes, even with judgments of people.
So what advice would you give a young rider concerning that?
I would just say, you know, get your head down and concentrate. You can do, you know, concentrate on your job and what you've got to do on the racetrack. And I think, you know, you've got all the time in the world if you want to go party, and, you know, just do it at appropriate times and be seen with the right people. Because, you know, in England they say birds of a feather stick together.
Yes.
And you can get sort of like tarnished with the same brush. So it's important that you don't, which is important.
Well, folks, we will continue our visit with jockey Daryl Holland after this very short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Daryl Holland. And Daryl, prior to the break, we were discussing your great year as an apprentice. You were the British Champion Apprentice in 91. You won the Leicester Award for Apprentice Jockey of the Year. And tell us what it was like. I know here in the States, when you lose your bug, as we call it, your apprenticeship, sometimes it's really difficult to gain mounts now that you don't have that weight allowance. What was it like for you once you lost that apprenticeship?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you lose your claim, you haven't got the weight advantage. You're on the same, you know, level playing field as all your peers. So then the owners and trainers have a choice. And sometimes, as you know, a lot of jockeys or young apprentices that have become fully fledged then, you know, drop away, you know, down the wayside. And I was fortunate enough. I was actually employed as Barry Hulsey's first jockey. I actually taken over from his son Michael, which was a big decision for his father at the time. And unfortunately, Michael got the sack, and you know, I filled his shoes. So you know, I did have a lot of firepower around me. I was finding myself on a lot of better stock, a lot of better thoroughbreds, and better class races. But you know, also with that came the pressures of that, or the expectations of you riding these better races. You couldn't make mistakes because I didn't have the weight allowance. I didn't have the 3 pound advantage. So I did find it tougher numerically. I went from obviously breaking that record. I dropped to 56 winners that year, and even though I say it was a drop, it was still probably a good achievement for my first year without my bug or without my claim. So I did find it tougher, and I was also at the better meetings as well. So that's where you find the better horses and the better jockeys. But I pulled through. I pulled through.
And Daryl, we've talked about all of your success all around the world. When did you first decide to travel to another country to ride?
Well, I visited Hong Kong. I'd also done a stint as an apprentice. My boss, Barry Hill, sent me to Lindsay Park in Australia. So I saw, you know, with the Hayes family, I think it was Colin Hayes at the time. And I went down there and I saw, you know, I saw different ways. You know, the Australians, they had the windmill style of whip, and I just thought it was a bit different. And I just always had in my, you know, in the back of my mind, I want to travel at some point. I mean, I'd been very good at geography at school. I'd passed an A-level at that. So it was always something, you know, different cultures and different experiences of food and, you know, all this that attracted me to traveling. And, you know, if you have a saddle, you can go anywhere in the world because it's normally a racetrack, which we are very lucky. My first experience was when I went to Hong Kong. I went to Happy Valley Racecourse, and it was just amazing. You know, when a horse, the favourite, lost, it just used to rain losing betting tickets. It was just a real, like in a cauldron and a goldfish bowl. It was a great sense of, a good atmosphere and a good vibe to it. So I decided the following year, after I'd spent two seasons with Barry Hills, that the Hong Kong Jockey Club approached me and said, did I want to come in the winter season? Or this is the off-season in England, because we race from March to November on the turf, and then the off-season is the in-between months, so it's November till March, where you can go to warmer climates and ply your trade there. So I took up the invitation with the Hong Kong Jockey Club, and I did really well. I was the leading club rider. I think I finished third in the title, having missed 4 months of the year. So then after it was getting towards the end of the season, they offered me a package deal to come for the full season. So I actually accepted it.
And you're happy there, obviously finding great success, Daryl. And you were the youngest foreign import into that competitive jockeys colony there in Hong Kong. That was in 94, correct? The year was 94?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. I was the youngest applicant or recipient to receive a license there. So I was relatively young. It was probably a big decision. It was probably a big decision by the Royal Hong Kong Jockey Club because of my age. But they took the gamble and they decided that, you know, they were going to take the chance with me. And, you know, I did very well. I think I rode four winners at Happy Valley one night. I rode numerous trebles. I went through there, though. I went through probably the worst patch as well, because I went through a patch where I didn't have a winner for, I think it was nearly 7 weeks. So that was my first experience of that. And to be honest, I didn't really cope well with it. But, you know, as I said, it was a learning, you know, learning curve for me, that you can't win all the time. And sometimes you just get on these, you know, runs that you cannot win. I think Steve Cawthon went through one. He was getting beat on some favourites and everything before he came to England. But any jockey goes through that. You just find yourself in the wrong place at the wrong time, or you make your run and you go for a gap and it's not there, and you're trying to make things happen too quickly, and you're not looking up and letting the race unfold in front of you, and you're making the wrong decisions. So it's not a nice period to go through, but you have to go through that if you're going to be a jockey.
I remember a time like that in my own career as well, Daryl. We all go through it, Like you said. And do you find that, you mentioned you're kind of trying too hard, you're in your head too much, and you're trying to make things happen instead of just letting it happen. And how do you conquer that? How do you get out of that kind of a rut?
It's a difficult one. I mean, it depends what sort of person you are. I mean, I'm a quite aggressive rider on the track. So I was kind of like making mistakes. And I just, you know, I'm thinking, where is it all going wrong? And, you know, these horses don't want to run for me anymore. You know, I'm getting all these kind of like weird feelings in my head. But in the end, I just snapped out of it, and I just sort of like calm it all down. And, you know, I just, if I rode in a 5 furlong sprint race, I would just slow everything down. And in my head, it was kind of like slow motion. And then I'd started, you know, I was starting to make the right decisions. And then it all fell back into place. It's like playing English soccer. You know, you get a goal scorer that no matter what he does, he cannot put the ball in the back of the net. And then all of a sudden, he gets a goal, and then they come like London buses. You know, it's one after the other. You cannot stop winning. Because then you get into a rhythm, and everything just falls naturally to you.
That's how this sport is. We have a lot of highs and lows in this game, Daryl. And it's a tough business, definitely, but the rewards are great. And how long did you stay there in Hong Kong?
I did, I think I did about 2.5 years there. I finished, I think the closest I got was in the championship, was third. It was very competitive, you know, colony to ride. We had jockeys from America. Gary Stevens came over for a stint. We had, you know, Damien Oliver. He was there, the Australian, one of the greats there. He's in the Hall of Fame. You know, we had jockeys from all around the world, France, you know, Gerald Mosset and Pat Edry used to come over. So it was a good... That was probably the best place I ever learned to ride and position a horse, because the handicap system's so tight. If there's 12 to 14 runners, there's normally 3 lengths separates the whole field. So you have to be in the right position, and you don't get any favours from the jockeys there. And we raced quite tight, so I learned a lot there, and it put me in good stead to when I returned.
And when you returned to Great Britain, I'm assuming.
I did. Well, as it happened, there was a trainer called Mark Johnson, who's still one of the leading trainers in the UK. He had a runner in the international meeting in December while I was over there. And I got a call from my previous agent in the UK. He said, Mark Johnson would like to speak to him and his business partner over dinner if you've got time. So I said, of course. So I met him at the Mandarin Hotel. We had a beautiful dinner and a nice chat. And he said to me, how would you like to be my first jockey? And I just jumped at the chance. You know, it was just a huge stable to go back to, with big owners. You know, the Sheikhs had horses in there. So it was a job that I couldn't refuse. The Hong Kong Jockey Club were disappointed I didn't stay for another season. But I always thought in the back of my mind, I can always go back there. But, you know, I just hadn't achieved, you know, enough in the UK. So that's why I went back.
So you wanted to go back and get that opportunity. And how did you find your return was received?
It was received well, actually. You know, there was obviously a few jockeys there, the younger jockeys that had come through that didn't know me, and, you know, I didn't know them. But, you know, all the older jockeys were still there, and, yeah, they, I mean, they embraced me and took me in again, and I did well. You know, from the start of the season, the first day of the season, I banged in two winners. So it was like I'd never left. I just stepped back in. But I found I was riding a lot better then. I was more mature in, you know, with people and owners, because it's a package deal. It's not just getting on the horse and riding a race and winning or losing. You know, you have to communicate with people and, you know, the press and stuff like that, and, you know, interviews on camera. It's the whole deal that you have to deal with. We're in such a commercial world now. You know, racing as a work, you know, as a fraternity is actually a smaller place. You know, we send horses now to Australia, you know, at the blink of an eyelid for the Melbourne Cup or the Breeders' Cup, wherever that may be in the States, as where 15 years ago, that would have been a big no-no, you know, the English sending horses afar. But, yeah, racing's definitely a smaller place worldwide.
It is indeed, Daryl. And I want to talk briefly about, you've had several rides in the Epsom Derby. And
yeah.
I want to talk about couple of those. You finished third in your very first Epsom Derby in 93. You were on Blues Traveler, who was 150-1.
Yeah, that's pretty fun memories. Yeah.
That's pretty incredible that you found so much run out of that horse. Tell us a little bit about that race.
Yeah, he was on obviously every jockey's dream, or sort of like English jockey certainly, is to win. So, you know, win the English Derby, that, you know, you just don't get better than that. I was riding a horse for Barry Hills at the time. It was a horse, you know, that I'd just gotten well with at home. It was a horse that had a big, long stride. He didn't have much speed. He stayed quite well. And it was a very gentle horse to ride. And, you know, Barry Hills said, I'm going to give you the leg up on that lad. I said, oh, great. And, you know, here I am, you know, riding one of the biggest races in the world as a relatively young lad. And it was a great opportunity, and he finished third. I mean, I came down the Tatnam Corner, just crossing the road there. I actually hit the front, and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to win. And then I got a couple past me at the end. But, yeah, he ran a superb race.
That had to be, for that split second when you were in front in the Epsom Derby, that just had to be the most amazing feeling in the world.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, normally when you ride, you can't hear the crowd roar because you're so focused on your mount, and, you know, you're communicating with your mount and you're squeezing your horse up or whatever. So you kind of like block all that out. But this was the first time I'd heard the roar when I hit the front. You know, you could see all the British flags waving, the London buses with the fairgrounds in the back. It was just a great experience, and obviously that was my first time I'd ever sort of like paraded onto the race course. I mean, it's a big deal, the Epsom Derby, as is the Kentucky Derby. You know, it's a great event just to be in, but to finish third was fantastic, you know, on that occasion.
Well, then you finished a place better in 2006. You were second aboard, this time 66-1 shot, Dragon Dancer.
Yeah, this was the one that it still hurts now talking about it. Yeah, he got beat a nose. I'd actually thought I'd won because the winner came up the inside on the rail, Martin Dwyer. It was on a horse called Sir Percy. And I had the Colmore runner in between. And then I was on the outside on Dragon's Dancer. Johnny Murta was in the middle. And he was on, you know, Martin, he was on my blind side. It's like driving a car and you can't see the car. Your wing mirror, they're that close, you know, to the other horse. And I'd actually crossed the line. I thought I'd won. And then as I was cantering back, I heard the numbers called up, and I looked at my cloth. I thought, they've got this wrong. Mm. And, yeah, Martin had won it. And, you know, Martin's a great friend, and I actually rang him. I was actually going to Chepstow that evening, and I didn't really want to go. I probably shouldn't have gone because I wasn't really up to it. You know, just getting beat. But I actually rang Martin on the way back and congratulated him. And, yeah, it wasn't to be.
Well, you were a good sport about it, but that had to be just a heartbreaking defeat when you think you won, and then the announcement comes out and you find that you were just beat at a nose.
Yeah, and, it's like any jockey riding in a race. You normally know whether you won the photograph or not. Mm-hmm. You know, I think 9 times out of 10, I know if I've won. You know, even if I have to wait for, you know, the photo call, you normally know whether you've won. And that was a race that I'd actually thought I'd won. You know, and I you know, the elation was building up, you know, the adrenaline, and I just thought I'd won it. And then to be told I hadn't won it, it was just so deflating. Mm. It was a horrible feeling.
Indeed. And you had a similar story in the 2003 Breeders' Cup. You were riding Falbrav for trainer Luca Kumon. Correct me if I mispronounced that name there, but Falbrav, you gave that horse a great ride, but similar in a heartbreaking defeat.
Falbrav, he was officially going into the race. He was the highest rated horse in the world. He was officially the best horse in the world. I'd won a Judmon International on him at Group 1. I'd won the QE2 on him, Group 1. I'd won the Coral Eclipse on him, Group 1. So, you know, I'd rode 3 or 4 Group 1s on him, and we were going into the race, you know, obviously with huge expectations. I sort of like, you know, we jumped out, I got a nice position, and sort of like round the back straight, I loomed up besides High Chaparral, and I had him pinned in on the rail. You know, I wasn't really going that well. So I thought, well, this is my chance. I'll have to make my move here, and, you know, Mick will have to wait for his run. And I thought I had it won, and then, boom, 2 horses got me right. And I think and the High Chaparral actually won the year before, the same race. So it was a dead heat for the 2 winners, Johor and the High Chaparral, and then I was a nose back in, well, 2nd or 3rd, however you want to look at it.
Goodness, yeah, heartbreaking defeat indeed, Daryl. To get the 2 had a dead heat. You weren't included in that. You were placed 3rd, but again, you gave that horse a great ride. I remember watching that race.
Yeah,
and what?
And I think. Sorry for interrupting. I think you know, if it wasn't for that race, you know, I wouldn't be here now, because I feel that I've got unfinished business, and that was my decision, getting beat in that race to come to Florida. So it's funny how life works and how life revolves.
It is funny. Everything happens for a reason, I believe, Daryl. And let's talk about that a little bit. You most recently spent quite a bit of time riding in South Korea, and you had great success there, of course. And tell us how you got along there, and then what made you get the decision to come here to the States.
Well, what it was, there was the chairman of the Korean Racing Association. They just opened it out to foreign jockeys. And I had a meeting with him in London, and he asked me, would I come to Korea and do a stint over there? He'd noticed that I'd rode in many countries, and, you know, he thought I'd fit in very well, obviously having experience in Asia before. So I seemed to fit the profile of what they wanted at the time. But I said to him, you know, because it was going so well in England, and I think I rode the most Group 1 winners as a jockey that year. I think I'd rode about 8 of Group 1 winners in one season. That I said to him it would be impossible, but I would promise you I would come in the near future. So I decided that I wanted a change, and I pinged him an email, and he responded, and he said, put your application in ASAP, which I did. So then I went over there, and I rode 2 winners on my first race meeting. Bearing in mind, this is all on the dirt, and I hadn't really had a lot of experience on the dirt. So, yeah, it was a good experience. Again, you know, this time I'd have to wear 4 or 5 pairs of goggles, which I'd never been used to flicking them down. All the reins weren't rubber or leather. They were actually these cloth reins. So that was a bit different. you know, and the weight was very difficult there. You know, you had to weigh with the breastplate, you had to weigh with a neck strap, you had to weigh with everything. As in England, you don't weigh with the extras, you only just weigh with your saddle and present yourself to the scales. So I had to sacrifice my body a bit more and ride at a lighter weight. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thoroughly enjoyed my time there. I think the last trip I did there, I rode the KRA mile, which is a classic race, $500,000 race. So, yeah, I left on a good note, and you know, but it was time to move on. You know when it's time to move on, and that was it. And you know, I just didn't want to leave America too late. You know, I was really, really wanted. I've got a young family. Now I've got, you know, twin babies, Leonardo and Isabella. And I wanted them to, you know, come to Florida and you know, and set up here.
That's wonderful, Daryl. And you mentioned the weight in South Korea and how it was, of course, much harder. I can't imagine trying to make weight with all of that extra equipment. But did you find that you ever had a problem with weight throughout your career? Or especially now in the States, it's a little bit lighter than in Europe.
Yeah, it is a bit lighter here than Europe. I think, you know, I do everything in moderation. You know, I'm not, you know, I wouldn't have a big plate of food. I'd always, you know, I'd only eat when I was hungry. You know, I wouldn't have a breakfast because it's breakfast time or a lunch because it's lunchtime. I'd sort of like eat when I was hungry, and I'd do everything in proportion, really. So I've been quite lucky that I am lightly boned, even though I'm quite tall for a jockey. But Korea was different. I had to sort of like diet for the first time, and I'd have to drop four pounds off in the sauna before racing. So the regime was a bit tougher, but the food's very healthy there, so that helped as well. You know, we didn't have burgers and all that there. It was more rice noodles and sushi and barbecue food, that sort of way. And so the diet helped me, helped my body.
How about working there in the mornings in South Korea? I know I struggled with my weight as well, and I always tried to keep busy in the mornings and sweat it off in the morning. What, were you busy there?
Yeah, I was. I think the only day we have off is a Tuesday there. So every other day, I'd be riding Friday, Sunday competitively. Every other day, I'd be riding 7 or 8 horses a morning. So, you know, you're kind of like a freelance when you arrive there, and then you're appointed a translator because, you know, not many people speak English. So you have to sort of like hustle for rides, so to speak. So if you didn't put the input in or the work ethic in, you wouldn't get the mounts. So, and, you know, I couldn't ride under the 54. So I'd lose a lot of, you know, rides as well. So, what I did have to get was try and pick out the best quality of the ones that got offered 54 and above. So I had to ride a lot of horses in the morning to do that.
Did you have an agent there?
Well, not as such. The translator, she acts like an agent, but is not unofficially an agent. She's appointed by the KRA purely to communicate with the, you know, orders for track work or orders for the races. But they would ask the translator, would Daryl like to ride this horse in the morning, see how it feels, and if he likes it, does he want to ride it? What distance, you know, and, you know, or does it need any equipment on or off? And so my input was important to them, and I think because they're sort of like trying to build up internationally, they held the KRA or Korean Racing Association, they actually held international meetings last year for the first time, and they held them this year as well for the second time. So it's a place that's going places, so, you know, good for them.
Definitely, Daryl. And then, as you mentioned, you came to the decision to ride in the States, bring your two little kids, and move to Florida. And then let me ask you this question, Daryl. Do you ever get tired of moving?
I don't. You could probably say I'm like a high-class gypsy, really. I don't know. I really like, you know, going to different places. I like meeting new people. It just intrigues me to do that, and I would encourage, you know, my children to do that, or I'd encourage anybody to travel. I think what it was, Christine, I missed out. I didn't have, like, normally after college, you have a gap year, and you normally go travelling with your mates to Thailand or wherever you want to go. But I missed out from when I was 15. I missed them teenage years, so to speak. So I kind of, like, missed out of a lot of things because, you know, I sacrificed everything into my job, being a jockey. So this has enabled me, and that now I've got to, so, you know, I've done okay, and, you know, places that I've been, it's given me a chance to travel a bit and do a bit what I want to do as well, and, you know, pull in my job with it as well, which is great, you know, because if you can ride a racehorse and you can pretty much go anywhere in the world, that's the beauty of our job. You know, you're not sat behind a desk.
It's a wonderful thing. I love it. I love it. Now, Daryl, tell me, of all the places you've traveled, where was your favorite?
Wow. Wow. That's a very, very hard question. It's like somebody saying, you know, comparing horses with, you know, they're all different. If you had to put my, I can't answer that. It's very difficult. I mean, Australia was great. I rode in the Melbourne Cup. I was third in the Melbourne Cup. I was number one on the card. Maccabi Diva won the race, and I led them. I mean, that was just a great place, Flemington. You know, 100,000 Aussies screaming. You know, a race that stops the nation. The Breeders' Cup was magnificent too. And hopefully I can go back there one day again, you know. It's very difficult. It's very, very, very hard to answer that question.
Well, you've had so many great opportunities to see so many different places. And if you were talking to a young rider who had similar opportunities, where would you say would be the best place to ride?
Well, I think America gives you a lot of opportunities, especially when you're a book rider. But I think it's also important that you've got to be grounded and do the right things early. I mean, mentally, you know, a lot of younger jockeys might not, you know, be comfortable traveling, you know, going to different countries. But, you know, if you get on good enough horses, they can take you there. I think if you're doing well in the country that you're in, France, England, them sort of places, that it's probably good to stay put for the time being, because, you know, a jockey's career can be short, it can be long too. You know, I'm 45 and still going. So,
well, Daryl,
you know, you've got
plenty
of time.
We are, speaking of time, we are all out of time, unfortunately. It has been such a pleasure having you here on the show, Daryl, and wishing
you
all the best in the States. Good luck here.
Cheers. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Folks, join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.